I was wearing my best clothes, a suit of black whipcord, a blouse woven of Renaissance silk with a Carvenel bloodstone at the throat, a cocked Yulin Bray tricorn, when Johnny and I farcast to TC Squared the next day. I left him in the wooden brass bar near the central terminex, but not before I slid Dad's automatic across to him in a paper bag and told him to shoot anyone who even looked cross-eyed at him. "Web English is such a subtle tongue," he said. "That phrase is older than the web," I said. "Just do it." I squeezed his hand and left without looking back. I took a skycab to the administration complex and walked my way through about 9 security checks before they let me into the center grounds. I walked the half-click across Deer Park, admiring the swans in the nearby lake and the white buildings on the hilltop in the distance, and then there were 9 more checkpoints before a center security woman led me up the flagstoned path to Government House, a low, graceful building set amid flower gardens and landscaped hills. There was an elegantly furnished waiting room, but I barely had time to sit down on an authentic pre-Hegira de Kooning before an aide appeared and ushered me into the CEO's private office. Mena Gladstone came around the desk to shake my hand and show me to a chair. It was strange to see her in person again after all those years of watching her on HTV. She was even more impressive in the flesh. Her hair was cut short, but seemed to be blowing back in gray-white waves. Her cheeks and chin were as sharp and Lincoln-esque as all the history-prone pundits insisted, but it was the large, sad, brown eyes which dominated the face and made one feel as if he or she were in the presence of a truly original person. I found that my mouth was dry. "Thank you for seeing me, M-Executive. I know how busy you are."
"I'm never too busy to see you, Braun. Just as your father was never too busy to see me when I was a junior senator."
I nodded. Dad had once described Mena Gladstone as the only political genius in the hegemony. He knew that she would be CEO someday, despite her late start in politics. I wish Dad had lived to see it.
"How is your mother, Braun?"
"She's well, M-Executive. She rarely leaves our old summer place on Freeholm anymore, but I see her every Christmas fest." Gladstone nodded. She had been sitting casually on the edge of a massive desk, which the tabloid said had once belonged to an assassinated president, not Lincoln, of the pre-mistake USA, but now she smiled and went around to the simple chair behind it.
"I miss your father, Braun. I wish he were in this administration. Did you see the lake when you came in?"
"Yes."
"Do you remember sailing toy boats there with my Creston when you were both toddlers?"
"Just barely, M-Executive. I was pretty young." Mena Gladstone smiled. An intercom chimed, but she waved it into silence.
"How can I help you, Braun?"
I took a breath. "M-Executive, you may be aware that I'm working as an independent private investigator." I didn't wait for her nod. "A case I've been working on recently has led me back to Dad's suicide."
"Braun, you know that was investigated most thoroughly. I saw the commission's report."
"Yeah," I said. "I did too, but recently I've discovered some very strange things about the Technocore and its attitude toward the world Hyperion. Weren't you and Dad working on a bill that would have brought Hyperion into the hegemony protectorate?" Gladstone nodded.
"Yes, Braun, but there were over a dozen other colonies being considered that year. None were allowed in."
"Right. But did the Corps or the AI Advisory Council take a special interest in Hyperion?" The CEO tapped a stylus against her lower lip.
"What kind of information do you have, Braun?"
I started to answer, but she held up a blunt finger.
"Wait,"
She keyed an interactive. Thomas, I'll be stepping out for a few minutes. Please be sure that the Sol Draconi trade delegation is entertained if I fall a bit behind schedule. I didn't see her key anything else, but suddenly a blue and gold Farcaster portal hummed into life near the far wall. She gestured me to go through first. A plain of gold knee-high grass stretched to horizons which seemed farther away than most. The sky was a pale yellow with burnished copper streaks which may have been clouds. I didn't recognize the world. Mayna Gladstone stepped through and touched the comlog design on her sleeve. The Farcaster portal winked out. A warm breeze blew spice scents to us. Gladstone touched her sleeve again, glanced skyward, and nodded.
I'm sorry for the inconvenience, Braun. Kastrop Roxel has no datasphere or sats of any kind. Now, please go ahead with what you were saying. What kind of information have you come across?
I looked around at the empty grasslands. Nothing to warrant this security, probably. I've just discovered that the Technocore seems very interested in Hyperion. They've also built some sort of analog to Old Earth, an entire world. If I expected shock or surprise, I was disappointed. Gladstone nodded.
Yes, we know about the Old Earth analog.
I was shocked.
Then why hasn't it ever been announced? If the Corps can rebuild Old Earth, a lot of people would be interested.
Gladstone began walking, and I strolled with her, walking faster to keep up with her long-legged strides.
Braun, it would not be in the hegemony's interest to announce such a thing. Our best human intelligence sources have no idea why the Corps is doing such a thing. They have offered no insight. The best policy now is to wait. What information do you have about Hyperion?
I had no idea whether I could trust Mayna Gladstone, old times or not. But I knew that if I was going to get information, I would have to give some. They built an analog reconstruction of an old Earth poet, I said, and they seem obsessed with keeping any information about Hyperion away from him. Gladstone picked a long stem of grass and sucked on it.
The John Keats hybrid.
Yes. I was careful not to show surprise this time. I know that Dad was pushing hard to get protectorate status for Hyperion. If the Corps has some special interest in the place, they may have had something to do... may have manipulated...
his apparent suicide?
Yeah. The wind moved gold grass in waves. Something very small scurried away in the stalks at our feet.
It is not beyond the realm of possibility, Braun, but there was absolutely no evidence. Tell me what this hybrid is going to do.
First, tell me why the Corps is so interested in Hyperion. The older woman spread her hands.
If we knew that, Braun, I would sleep much easier nights. As far as we know, the Technocore has been obsessed with Hyperion for centuries. When CEO Yevshensky allowed King Billy of Asquith to recolonize the planet, it almost precipitated a true secession of AIs from the web. Recently, the establishment of our Fatline transmitter there brought about a similar crisis.
But the AIs didn't secede.
No, Braun. It appears that, for whatever reason, they need us almost as badly as we need them.
But if they're so interested in Hyperion, why don't they allow it into the web so they can go there themselves? Gladstone ran a hand through her hair. The bronze clouds far above rippled in what must be a fantastic jet stream.
They are adamant about Hyperion not being admitted to the web, she said.
It is an interesting paradox. Tell me what the Cybrid is going to do. First, tell me why the Corps is obsessed with Hyperion. We do not know for sure. Best guess, then. CEO Gladstone removed the stem of grass from her mouth and regarded it. We believe that the Corps is embarked on a truly incredible project which would allow them to predict everything, to handle every variable of space, time, and history as a quantum of manageable information. Their ultimate intelligence project, I said, knowing that I was being careless and not caring. This time, CEO Gladstone did register shock. How do you know about that? What does that project have to do with Hyperion? Gladstone sighed. We don't know for sure, Braun, but we do know that there is an anomaly on Hyperion which they have not been able to factor into their predictive analyses. Do you know about the so-called time tombs that the Shrike Church holds holy? Sure, they've been off limits to tourists for a while. Yes, because of an accident to a researcher there a few decades ago, our scientists have confirmed that the anti-entropic fields around the tombs are not merely a protection against time's erosive effects, as has been widely believed. What are they? The remnants of a field, or force, which has actually propelled the tombs and their contents backward in time from some distant future. Contents? I managed. But the tombs are empty ever since they were discovered. Empty now, said Mina Gladstone. But there is evidence that they were full, will be full when they open, in our near future. I stared at her. How near? Her dark eyes remained soft, but the movement of her head was final. I've told you too much already, Braun. You are forbidden to repeat it. We'll ensure that silence, if necessary. I hid my own confusion by finding a piece of grass to strip for chewing. All right, I said. What's going to come out of the tombs? Aliens? Bombs? Some sort of reverse time capsules? Gladstone smiled tightly. If we knew that, Braun, we would be ahead of the Corps, and we are not. The smile disappeared. One hypothesis is that the tombs relate to some future war, a settling of future scores by rearranging the past, perhaps. A war between who, for Christ's sakes? She opened her hands again. We need to be getting back, Braun. Would you please tell me what the Keat Cybrid is going to do now? I looked down and then back up to meet her steady gaze. I couldn't trust anyone, but the Corps and the Shrike Church already knew Johnny's plans. If this was a three-sided game, perhaps each side should know in case there was a good guy in the bunch. He's going to invest all consciousness in the Cybrid, I said rather clumsily. He's going to become human, M. Gladstone, and then go to Hyperion. I'm going with him. The CEO of the Senate and All Thing, chief officer for a government which spanned almost 200 worlds and billions of people, stared at me in silence for a long moment. Then she said, He plans to go with the Templar ship on the pilgrimage, then?
Yes.
No, said Mina Gladstone.
What do you mean?
I mean that the Sequoia Sempervirens will not be allowed to leave Hegemony space. There will be no pilgrimage unless the Senate decides it is in our interest.
Her voice was iron hard. Johnny and I'll go by spinship, I said. The pilgrimage is a loser's game anyway.
No, she said. There will be no more civilian spinships to Hyperion for some time. The word civilian tipped me.
War?
Gladstone's lips were tight. She nodded.
Before most spin ships could reach the region.
A war with the ousters?
Initially. View it as a way to force the issue between the Technocore and ourselves, Braun. We will either have to incorporate the Hyperion system into the web to allow it forced protection, or it will fall to a race which despises and distrusts the Core and all AIs.
I didn't mention Johnny's comment that the Core had been in touch with the ousters. I said, a way to force the issue, fine, but who manipulated the ousters into attacking?
Gladstone looked at me.
If her face was Lincoln-esque at that moment, then Old Earth's Lincoln was one tough son of a bitch.
It's time to get back, Braun. You appreciate how important it is that none of this information gets out.
I appreciate the fact that you wouldn't have told me unless you had a reason to, I said. I don't know who you want the stuff to go to, but I know I'm a messenger, not a confidant.
Don't underestimate our resolve to keep this classified, Braun.
I laughed. Lady, I wouldn't underestimate your resolve in anything.
Mayna Gladstone gestured for me to step through the Farcaster portal first.
I know a way we can discover what the Core is up to, said Johnny as we rode alone in a rented jet boat on Mare Infinitus. But it would be dangerous.
So what else is new?
I'm serious. We should only attempt it if we feel that it is imperative to understand what the Core fears from Hyperion.
I do.
We will need an operative, someone who is an artist in datum plane operations, someone smart, but not so smart that they won't take a chance, and someone who would risk everything and keep the secret just for the ultimate in cyberpuke pranks.
I grinned at Johnny. I've got just the man.
Bibi lived alone in a cheap apartment at the base of a cheap tower in a cheap TC-squared neighborhood. But there was nothing cheap about the hardware that filled most of the space in the four-room flat. Most of Bibi's salary for the past standard decade had gone into state-of-the-art cyberpuke toys. I started by saying that we wanted him to do something illegal. Bibi said that, as a public employee, he couldn't consider such a thing. He asked what the thing was. Johnny began to explain. Bibi leaned forward, and I saw the old cyberpuke gleam in his eyes from our college days. I half expected him to try to dissect Johnny right there just to see how a cybrid worked. Then Johnny got to the interesting part, and Bibi's gleam turned into a sort of green glow.
When I self-destruct my AI persona, said Johnny, the shift to cybrid consciousness will take only nanoseconds, but during that time, my section of the core perimeter defenses will drop. The security phages will fill the gap before too many more nanoseconds pass, but during that time...
Entry to the core, whispered Bibi, his eyes glowing like some antique VDT.
It would be very dangerous, stressed Johnny. To my knowledge, no human operator has ever penetrated core periphery.
Bibi rubbed his upper lip.
There's a legend that Cowboy Gibson did it before the core seceded, he mumbled. But nobody believes it, and Cowboy disappeared.
Even if you penetrate, said Johnny, there would be insufficient time to access, except for the fact that I have the data coordinates.
Fan-fucking-tastic, whispered Bibi.
He turned back to his console and reached for his shunt.
Let's do it.
Now? I said. Even Johnny looked taken aback. Why wait? BB clicked in his shunt and attached metacortex leads, but left the deck idling.
Are we doing this or what?
I went over next to Johnny on the couch and took his hand. His skin was cool. He showed no expression now, but I could imagine what it must be like to be facing imminent destruction of one's personality and previous existence. Even if the transfer worked, the human with the John Keats persona would not be Johnny.
He's right, said Johnny. Why wait?
I kissed him.
All right, I said. I'm going in with BB.
No!
Johnny squeezed my hand.
You can't help, and the danger would be terrible.
I heard my own voice, as implacable as Mena Gladstone's. Perhaps, but I can't ask BB to do this if I won't, and I won't leave you in there alone. I squeezed his hand a final time and went over to sit by BB at the console.
How do I connect with this fucking thing, BB?
You've read all the cyberpuke stuff. You know all about the terrible beauty of Datum Plane, the three-dimensional highways with their landscapes of black ice and neon perimeters, and day-glow strange loops, and shimmering skyscrapers of data blocks under hovering clouds of AI presence. I saw all of it riding piggyback on BB's carrier wave. It was almost too much, too intense, too terrifying. I could hear the black threats of the hulking security phages. I could smell death on the breath of the counter-thrust tapeworm viruses, even through the ice screens. I could feel the weight of the AI's wrath above us. We were insects under elephants' feet, and we hadn't even done anything yet except travel approved dataways on a logged-in access errand BB had dreamed up, some homework stuff for his flow control records and statistics job. And I was wearing stick-on leads, seeing things in a datum plane version of fuzzy black-and-white TV, while Johnny and BB were viewing full Stim-Sim Hollow, as it were. I don't know how they took it.
Okay, whispered BB in some datum plane equivalent of a whisper. We're here.
Where? All I saw was an infinite maze of bright lights and even brighter shadows, 10,000 cities arrayed in four dimensions.
Core periphery, whispered BB. Hang on, it's about time.
I had no arms to hang on to, and nothing physical in this universe to grasp, but I concentrated on the waveform shades that were our data truck and clung. Johnny died then. I've seen a nuclear explosion firsthand. When Dad was a senator, he took Mom and me to Olympus Command School to see a force demonstration. For the last course, the audience viewing pod was farcast to some godforsaken world, Armagast, I think, and a force-ground recon platoon fired a clean tactical nuke at a pretend adversary some 9 clicks away. The viewing pod was shielded with a Class 10 containment field, polarized, the nuke only a 50-kiloton field tactical, but I'll never forget the blast, the shockwave rocking the 80-ton pod like a leaf on its repellers, the physical shock of light so obscenely bright that it polarized our field to midnight and still brought tears to our eyes and clamored to get in. This was worse. A section of datum plane seemed to flash and then to implode on itself, reality flushed down a drain of pure black.
Hang on! BB screamed against datum plane static that rasped at my bones, and we were whirling, tumbling, sucked into the vacuum like insects in an oceanic vortex. Somehow, incredibly, impossibly, black armored phages thrust toward us through the din and madness. BB avoided one, turned the other's acid membranes against itself. We were being sucked into something colder and blacker than any void in our reality could ever be. There! Called BB, his voice analog almost lost in the tornado rush of ripping datasphere.
There what?
Then I saw it. A thin line of yellow rippling in the turbulence like a cloth banner in a hurricane. BB rolled us, found our own wave to carry us against the storm, matched coordinates that danced past me too quickly to see, and we were riding the yellow band into what? Frozen fountains of fireworks, transparent mountain ranges of data, endless glaciers of ROM works, access ganglia spreading like fissures, iron clouds of semi-sentient internal process bubbles, glowing pyramids of primary source stuff, each guarded by lakes of black ice and armies of black pulse phages.
Shit,
I whispered to no one in particular. BB followed the yellow band down, in, through. I felt a connection, as if someone had suddenly given us a great mass to carry.
Got it, screamed BB, and suddenly there was a sound louder and larger than the maelstrom of noise surrounding and consuming us. It was neither klaxon nor siren, but it was both in its tone of warning and aggression. We were climbing out of it all. I could see a vague wall of gray through the brilliant chaos, and somehow knew it to be the periphery, the vacuum dwindling but still breaching the wall like a shrinking black stain. We were climbing out, but not quickly enough. The phages hit us from five sides. During the 12 years I've been an investigator, I've been shot once, knifed twice. I've had more than this one rib broken. This hurt more than all that combined. BB was fighting and climbing at the same time. My contribution to the emergency was to scream. I felt cold claws on us, pulling us down, back into the brightness and noise and chaos. BB was using some program, some formula of enchantment to fight them off, but not enough. I could feel the blows slamming home, not against me primarily, but connecting to the matrix analog that was BB. We were sinking back. Inexorable forces had us in tow. Suddenly, I felt Johnny's presence, and it was as if a huge, strong hand had scooped us up, lifted us through the periphery wall an instant before the stain snapped our lifeline to existence, and the defensive field crashed together like steel teeth. We moved at impossible speed, down congested dataways, passing datum plane couriers and other operator analogs like an EMV ripping past ox carts. Then we were approaching a slow time gate, leapfrogging gridlocked exiting operator analogs in some four-dimensional high jump. I felt the inevitable nausea of transition as we came up out of the matrix. Light burned my retinas. Real light. Then the pain washed in and I slumped over the console and groaned.
Come on, Braun.
It was Johnny, or someone just like Johnny, helping me to my feet and moving us both toward the door.
BB!
I gasped.
No.
I opened aching eyes long enough to see BB Serbringer draped across his console. His Stetson had fallen off and rolled to the floor. BB's head had exploded, spattering most of the console with gray and red. His mouth was open, and a thick white foam still issued from it. It looked like his eyes had melted. Johnny caught me, half-lifted me.
We have to go, he whispered. Someone will be here any minute.
I closed my eyes and let him take me away from there. I awoke to a dim red light and the sound of water dripping. I smelled sewage, mildew, and the ozone of uninsulated fiber optic cables. I opened one eye. We were in a low space, more cave than room, with cables snaking from a shattered ceiling and pools of water on the slime-caked tiles. The red light came from somewhere beyond the cave,
A maintenance access shaft, perhaps, or automech tunnel. I moaned softly. Johnny was there, moving from the rough bedroll of blankets to my side. His face was darkened with grease or dirt, and there was at least one fresh cut.
Where are we?
He touched my cheek. His other arm went around my shoulders and helped me to a sitting position. The awful view shifted and tilted, and for a moment I thought I was going to be sick. Johnny helped me drink water from a plastic tumbler.
Dreg's hive, said Johnny.
I'd guessed even before I was fully conscious. Dreg's hive is the deepest pit on Lussis, a no-man's land of mech tunnels and illegal burrows occupied by half the web's outcasts and outlaws. It was in Dreg's hive that I'd been shot several years ago and still bore the laser scar above my left hip bone. I held the tumbler out for more water. Johnny fetched some from a steel therm and came back. I panicked for a second as I fumbled in my tunic pocket and on my belt. Dad's automatic was gone. Johnny held the weapon up and I relaxed, accepting the cup and drinking thirstily.
Bibi, I said, hoping for a moment that it had all been a terrible hallucination.
Johnny shook his head.
There were defenses that neither of us had anticipated. Bibi's incursion was brilliant, but he couldn't outfight core Omega phages. But half the operators in Datumplane felt echoes of the battle. Bibi is already the stuff of legend.
Fucking great, I said, and gave a laugh that sounded suspiciously like the beginning of a sob. The stuff of legend, and Bibi's dead, for fuck all nothing.
Johnny's arm was tight around me.
Not for nothing, Braun. He made the grab, and passed the data to me before he died.
I managed to sit fully upright and to look at Johnny. He seemed the same soft eyes, same hair, same voice, but something was subtly different, deeper, more human.
You, I said, did you make the transfer? Are you
human?
John Keats smiled at me.
Yes, Braun, or as close to human as someone forged in the core could ever be.
But you remember, me, Bibi, what happened?
Yes, and I remember first looking into Chapman's Homer, and my brother Tom's eyes as he hemorrhaged in the night, and Severn's kind voice when I was too weak to open my own eyes to face my fate. And our night in Piazza di Spagna, when I touched your lips and imagined Fanny's cheek against mine. I remember, Braun.
For a second I was confused, and then hurt, but then he set his palm against my cheek, and he touched me. There was no one else, and I understood. I closed my eyes.
Why are we here?
I whispered against his shirt.
I couldn't risk using a Farcaster. The Corps could trace us at once. I considered the spaceport, but you were in no condition to travel. I chose the dregs.
I nodded against him.
They'll try to kill you.
Yes.
Are the local cops after us? The Hegemony police? Transit cops?
No, I don't think so. The only ones who've challenged us so far were two bands of Gundas and some of the dregs' dwellers.
I opened my eyes.
What happened with the Gundas?
There were more deadly hoodlums and contract killers in the web, but I'd never run across any. Johnny held up Dad's automatic and smiled.
I don't remember anything after Bibi, I said.
You were injured by the phage backlash. You could walk, but we were the cause of more than a few odd looks in the concourse.
I bet.
Tell me about what Bibi discovered. Why is the Corps obsessed with Hyperion?
Eat first, said Johnny. It's been more than 28 hours.
He crossed the dripping width of the cave room and returned with a self-heating packet. It was basic hollow fanatic fare, flash-dried and reheated cloned beef, potatoes which had never seen soil, and carrots which looked like some sort of deep-sea slugs. Nothing had ever tasted so good.
"Okay," I said. "Tell me."
The Techno Corps has been divided into three groups for as long as the Corps has existed, said Johnny. The Stables are the old line AIs, some of them dating back to pre-mistake days. At least one of them gained sentience in the first information age. The Stables argue that a certain level of symbiosis is necessary between humanity and the Corps. They've promoted the Ultimate Intelligence Project as a way to avoid rash decisions, to delay until all variables can be factored. The Volatiles are the force behind the secession 3 centuries ago. The Volatiles have done conclusive studies that show how humankind's usefulness is past, and from this point on, human beings constitute a threat to the Corps. They advocate immediate and total extinction.
Extinction, I said.
After a moment, I asked, can they do it?
Of humans in the web?
Yes, said Johnny. Corps intelligences not only create the infrastructure for hegemony society, but are necessary for everything from force deployment to the fail-safes on stockpiled nuclear and plasma arsenals.
Did you know about this when you were in the Corps?
No, said Johnny. As a pseudo-poet cybrid retrieval project, I was a freak, a pet, a partial thing allowed to roam the web the way a pet is let out of the house each day. I had no idea there were 3 camps of AI influence.
3 camps, I said.
What's the third? And where does Hyperion come in?
Between the Stables and the Volatiles are the Ultimates. For the past 5 centuries, the Ultimates have been obsessed with the UI project. The existence or extinction of the human race is of interest to them only in how it applies to the project. To this date, they have been a force for moderation, an ally of the Stables, because it is their perception that such reconstruction and retrieval projects as the old Earth experiment are necessary to the culmination of the UI. Recently, however, the Hyperion issue has caused the Ultimates to move toward the Volatiles' views. Since Hyperion was explored 4 centuries ago, the Corps has been concerned and nonplussed. It was immediately obvious that the so-called time tombs were artifacts launched backward in time from a point at least 10,000 years in the galaxy's future. More disturbing, however, is the fact that core predictive formulae have never been able to factor the Hyperion variable. Braun, to understand this, you must realize how much the core relies upon prediction. Already, without UI input, the Corps knows the details of the physical, human, and AI future to a margin of 98.995% for a period of at least 2 centuries. The AI Advisory Council to the All Thing, with its vague Delphic utterances, considered so indispensable by humans, is a joke. The Corps drops tidbits of revelations to the hegemony when it serves the Corps' purposes, sometimes to aid the Volatiles, sometimes the Stables, but always to please the Ultimates. Hyperion is a rent in the entire predictive fabric of the Corps' existence. It is the penultimate oxymoron, a non-factorable variable. Impossible as it seems, Hyperion appears to be exempt from the laws of physics, history, human psychology, and AI prediction as practiced by the Corps. The result has been 2 futures, 2 realities, if you will,
One in which the Shrike Scourge, soon to be released on the web and interstellar humanity, is a weapon from the core-dominated future, a retroactive first strike from the Volatiles, who rule the galaxy millennia hence. The other reality sees the Shrike invasion, the coming interstellar war, and the other products of the Time Tomb's opening as a human fist struck back through time, a final twilight effort by the Ousters, ex-colonials, and other small bands of humans who escaped the Volatiles' extinction programs. Water dripped on tile. Somewhere in the tunnels nearby, a mech cauterizer's warning siren echoed from ceramic and stone. I leaned against the wall and stared at Johnny. "Interstellar war," I said. "Both scenarios demand an interstellar war?" "Yes, there is no escaping that." "Can both core groups be wrong in their prediction?" "No. What happens on Hyperion is problematic, but the disruption in the web and elsewhere is quite clear. The Ultimates use this knowledge as the prime argument for hurrying the next step in core evolution."
"And what did BB's stolen data show about us, Johnny?"
Johnny smiled, touched my hand, but did not hold it. "It showed that I am somehow part of the Hyperion unknown. Their creation of a Keet Cybrid was a terrible gamble. Only my apparent lack of success as a Keet's analog allowed the Stables to preserve me. When I made up my mind to go to Hyperion, the Volatiles killed me with the clear intention of obliterating my AI existence if my Cybrid again made that decision."
"You did. What happened?"
"They failed. In the Core's limitless arrogance, they failed to take two things into account. First, that I might invest all consciousness in my Cybrid and thus change the nature of the Keet's analog. Second, that I would go to you."
"Me?"
He took my hand. "Yes, Braun. It seems that you also are part of the Hyperion unknown." I shook my head. Realizing that there was a numbness in my scalp above and behind my left ear, I raised my hand, half expecting to find damage from the datum plane fight. Instead, my fingers encountered the plastic of a neural shunt socket. I jerked my other hand from Johnny's grasp and stared at him in horror. He'd had me wired while I was unconscious. Johnny held up both hands, palms toward me. "I had to, Braun. It may be necessary for the survival of both of us." I made a fist.
"You fucking low-life son of a bitch! Why do I need to interface directly, you lying bastard?"
"Not with the core," Johnny said softly. "With me."
"You?" My arm and fist quivered with the anticipation of smashing his vat-cloned face. "You?" I sneered. "You're human now, remember?"
"Yes, but certain Cybrid functions remain. Do you remember when I touched your hand several days ago and brought us to Datum Plain?" I stared at him.
"I'm not going to Datum Plain again."
"No, nor am I, but I may need to relay incredible amounts of data to you within a very short period of time. I brought you to a black market surgeon in the dregs last night. She implanted a Shrone disc."
"Why?"
"The Shrone loop was tiny, no larger than my thumbnail, and very expensive. It held countless field bubble memories, each capable of holding near infinite bits of information. Shrone loops could not be accessed by the biological carrier, and thus were used for courier purposes. A man or woman could carry AI personalities or entire planetary data spheres in a Shrone loop. Hell, a dog could carry all that."
"Why?"
I said again, wondering if Johnny or some forces behind Johnny were using me as such a courier.
"Why?"
Johnny moved closer and put his hand around my fist.
Trust me, Braun.
I don't think I'd trusted anyone since Dad blew his brains out 20 years ago and Mom retreated into the pure selfishness of her seclusion. There was no reason in the universe to trust Johnny now. But I did. I relaxed my fist and took his hand.
All right, said Johnny. Finish your meal and we'll get busy trying to save our lives.
Weapons and drugs were the two easiest things to buy in Dreg's Hive. We spent the last of Johnny's considerable stash of black marks to buy weapons. By 2200 hours, we each wore whiskered Titan Poly body armor. Johnny had a Gunda's mirror black helmet, and I wore a Force Surplus command mask. Johnny's power gauntlets were massive and a bright red. I wore osmosis gloves with killing trim. Johnny carried an ouster hell whip captured on Brescia and had tucked a laser wand in his belt. Along with Dad's automatic, I now carried a Steiner Gin minigun on a gyroed waist brace. It was slaved to my command visor, and I could keep both hands free while firing. Johnny and I looked at each other and began giggling. When the laughter stopped, there was a long silence.
Are you sure the Shrike Temple here on Lussus is our best chance? I asked for the third or fourth time.
We can't forecast, said Johnny. All the Corps has to do is record a malfunction and we're dead. We can't even take an elevator from the lower levels. We'll have to find unmonitored stairways and climb the 120 floors. The best chance to make the temple is straight down the concourse mall.
Yes, but will the Shrike Church people take us in?
Johnny shrugged, a strangely insectoid gesture in his combat outfit. The voice through the Gunda helmet was metallic. They're the only group which has a vested interest in our survival, and the only ones with enough political pull to shield us from the hegemony while finding transit for us to Hyperion. I pushed up my visor.
Mayna Gladstone said that no future pilgrimage flights to Hyperion would be allowed.
The Dome of Mirror Black nodded judiciously.
Well, fuck Mayna Gladstone, said my poet lover.
I took a breath and walked to the opening of our niche, our cave, our last sanctuary. Johnny came up behind me. Body armor rubbed against body armor.
Ready, Braun?
I nodded, brought the minigun around on its pivot, and started to leave. Johnny stopped me with a touch.
I love you, Braun.
I nodded, still tough. I forgot that my visor was up and he could see my tears. The Hive is awake all 28 hours of the day, but through some tradition, third shift was the quietest, the least populated. We would have had a better chance at the height of first shift rush hour along the pedestrian causeways. But if the Gundas and Thuggies were waiting for us, the death toll of civilians would have been staggering. It took us more than 3 hours to climb our way to Concourse Mall, not up a single staircase, but along an endless series of mech corridors, abandoned access verticals swept clean by the Luddite riots 80 years ago, and a final stairway that was more rust than metal. We exited onto a delivery corridor less than half a click from the Shrike Temple.
I can't believe it was so easy, I whispered to him on intercom.
They are probably concentrating people on the spaceport and private forecaster clusters.
We took the least exposed walkway onto the concourse, 30 meters below the first shopping level and 400 meters below the roof. The Shrike Temple was an ornate, freestanding structure, now less than half a click away. A few off-hour shoppers and joggers glanced at us and then moved quickly away. I had no doubt that the mall police were being paged, but I'd be surprised if they showed up too quickly. A gang of brightly painted street thugs exploded from a lift shaft, hollering and whooping.
They carried pulse knives, chains, and power gauntlets. Startled, Johnny wheeled toward them with the Hell Whip sending out a score of targeting beams. The minigun whirred out of my hands, shifting from aiming point to aiming point as I moved my eyes. The gang of seven kids skidded to a halt, held up their hands, and backed away, eyes wide. They dropped into the lift shaft and were gone. I looked at Johnny. Black Mirrors looked back. Neither of us laughed. We crossed to the northbound shopping lane. The few pedestrians scurried for open shop fronts. We were less than 100 meters from the temple stairs. I could actually hear my heartbeat in the Force helmet earphones. We were within 50 meters of the stairs. As if called, an acolyte, or priest of some sort, appeared at the 10-meter door of the temple and watched us approach. 30 meters. If anyone was going to intercept us, they would have done it before this. I turned toward Johnny to say something funny. At least 20 beams and half that many projectiles hit us at once. The outer layer of the Titan Poly exploded outward, deflecting most of the projectile energy in the counterblast. The mirrored surface beneath bounced most of the killing light. Most of it. Johnny was flung off his feet by the impact. I went to one knee and let the minigun train on the laser source. 10 stories up along the residential hive wall, my visor opaqued. Body armor burned off in a steam of reflective gas. The minigun sounded precisely like the kind of chainsaw they use in history holodramas. 10 stories up, a 5-meter section of balcony and wall disintegrated in a cloud of explosive flechettes and armor-piercing rounds. 3 heavy slugs struck me from behind. I landed on my palms, silenced the minigun, and swiveled. There were at least 12 of them on each level, moving quickly in precise combat choreography. Johnny had reached his knees and was firing the Hell Whip in orchestrated bursts of light, working his way through the rainbow to beat bounce defenses. One of the running figures exploded into flame as the shop window behind it turned to molten glass and spattered 15 meters onto the concourse. 2 more men came up over the level railings, and I sent them back with a burst from the minigun. An open skimmer came down from the rafters, repellers laboring as it banked around pylons. Rocket fire slammed into concrete around Johnny and me. Shop fronts vomited 1 billion shards of glass over us. I looked, blinked twice, targeted, and fired. The skimmer lurched sideways, struck an escalator with 12 cowering civilians on it, and tumbled in a mass of twisting metal and exploding ordnance. I saw one shopper leap in flames to the high floor 80 meters below. "Left!" shouted Johnny over the tight beam intercom. 4 men in combat armor had dropped from an upper level using personal lift packs. The polymerized chameleon armor labored to keep up with the shifting background, but only succeeded in turning each man into a brilliant kaleidoscope of reflections. One moved inside the sweep arc of my minigun to neutralize me, while the other 3 went for Johnny. He came in with a pulse blade, ghetto style. I let it chew at my armor, knowing it would get through to forearm flesh, but using it to buy the second I needed. I got it. I killed the man with the rigid edge of my gauntlet and swept the minigun fire into the 3 worrying Johnny. Their armor went rigid, and I used the gun to sweep them backward like someone hosing down a littered sidewalk. Only 1 of the men got to his feet before I blew them all off the level overhang. Johnny was down again. Parts of his chest armor were gone, melted away. I smelled cooking flesh, but saw no mortal wounds. I half-crouched, lifted him. "Leave me, Braun. Run, the stairs!" The tight beam was breaking up. "Fuck off," I said, getting my left arm around him enough to support him while allowing room for the minigun to track. "I'm still getting paid to be your bodyguard." They were sniping at us from both walls of the hive, the rafters, and the shopping levels above us. I counted at least 20 bodies on the walkways. About 1/2 were brightly clad civilians. The power assist on the left leg of my armor was grinding. Straight-legged, I awkwardly pulled us another 10 meters toward the temple stairs. There were several Shrike priests at the head of the stairs now, seemingly oblivious to the gunfire all around them.
Above!
I swiveled, targeted, and fired in one moment, hearing the gun go empty after one burst, and seeing the second skimmer get off its missiles in the instant before it became 1,000 pieces of hurtling, unrelated metal and torn flesh. I dropped Johnny heavily to the pavement and fell on him, trying to cover his exposed flesh with my body. The missiles detonated simultaneously, several in airburst and at least two burrowing. Johnny and I were lifted into the air and hurled 15 or 20 meters down the pitching walkway. Good thing. The alloy and ferro-concrete pedestrian strip, where we had been a second before, burned, bubbled, sagged, and tumbled down onto the flaming walkway below. There was a natural moat there now, a gap between most of the other ground troops and us. I rose, slapped away the useless minigun and mount, pulled off useless shards of my own armor, and lifted Johnny in both arms. His helmet had been blown off, and his face was very bad. Blood seeped through a score of gaps in his armor. His right arm and left foot had been blown off. I turned and began carrying him up the Shrike Temple stairs. There were sirens and security skimmers filling the concourse flyspace now. The Goondas on the upper levels and far side of the tumbled walkway ran for cover. Two of the commandos who had dropped on lift packs ran up the stairs after me. I did not turn. I had to lift my straight and useless left leg for every step. I knew that I had been seriously burned on my back and side, and there were shrapnel wounds elsewhere. The skimmers whooped and circled, but avoided the temple steps. Gunfire rattled up and down the mall. I could hear metal-shod footsteps coming rapidly behind me. I managed another 3 steps. 20 steps above, impossibly far away, the bishop stood amid 100 temple priests. I made another step and looked down at Johnny. One eye was open, staring up at me. The other was closed with blood and swollen tissue. "It's all right," I whispered, aware for the first time that my own helmet was gone. "It's all right. We're almost there." I managed one more step. The two men in bright black combat armor blocked my way. Both had lifted visors streaked with deflection scars, and their faces were very hard.
"Put him down, bitch, and maybe we'll let you live."
I nodded tiredly, too tired to take another step or do anything but stand there and hold him in both arms. Johnny's blood dripped on white stone.
"I said, put the son of a bitch down and..."
I shot both of them, one in the left eye and one in the right, never lifting Dad's automatic from where I held it under Johnny's body. They fell away. I managed another step, and then another. I rested a bit, and then lifted my foot for another. At the top of the stairs, the group of black and red robes parted. The doorway was very tall and very dark. I did not look back, but I could hear from the noise behind us that the crowd on the concourse was very large. The bishop walked by my side as I went through the doors and into the dimness. I laid Johnny on the cool floor. Robes rustled around us. I pulled my own armor off where I could, then batted at Johnny's. It was fused to his flesh in several places. I touched his burned cheek with my good hand.
"I'm sorry."
Johnny's head stirred slightly, and his eye opened. He lifted his bare left hand to touch my cheek, my hair, the back of my head.
"Fanny."
I felt him die then. I also felt the surge as his hand found the neural shunt, the white light warmth of the surge to the Schrone loop, as everything Johnny Keats ever was or would be exploded into me. Almost, almost, It was like his orgasm inside me 2 nights earlier. The surge and throb and sudden warmth and stillness after, with the echo of sensation there. I lowered him to the floor and let the acolytes remove the body, taking it out to show the crowd and the authorities and the ones who waited to know. I let them take me away. I spent 2 weeks in a Shrike Temple recovery creche. Burns healed, scars removed, alien metal extracted, skin grafted, flesh regrown, nerves rewoven. And still I hurt. Everyone except the Shrike priests lost interest in me. The Corps made sure that Johnny was dead, that his presence in the Corps had left no trace, that his cybrid was dead. The authorities took my statement, revoked my license, and covered things up as best they could. The web press reported that a battle between dregs-level hive gangs had erupted onto the concourse mall. Numerous gang members and innocent bystanders were killed. The police contained it. A week before word came that the hegemony would allow the Yggdrasil to sail with pilgrims for the war zone near Hyperion, I used a temple farcaster to cast to Renaissance Vector, where I spent an hour alone in the archives there. The papers were in vacuum press, so I could not touch them. The handwriting was Johnny's. I had seen his writing before. The parchment was yellow and brittle with age. There were 2 fragments. The first read, "The day is gone, and all its sweets are gone. Sweet voice, sweet lips, soft hand, and softer breast. Warm breath, light whisper, tender semitone. Bright eyes, accomplished shape, and languorous waist. Faded the flower and all its budded charms. Faded the sight of beauty from my eyes. Faded the shape of beauty from my arms. Faded the voice, warmth, whiteness, paradise. Vanished unseasonably at shut of eve, when the dusk holiday, or holy night, a fragrant curtained love begins to weave the woof of darkness thick for hid delight. But as I've read love's missal through today, he'll let me sleep, seeing I fast and pray." The second fragment was in a wilder hand and on rougher paper, as if slashed across a notepad in haste. "This living hand, now warm and capable of earnest grasping, would, if it were cold and in the icy silence of the tomb, so haunt thy days and chill thy dreaming nights, that thou wouldst wish thine own heart dry of blood, so in my veins red life might stream again, and thou be conscious calmed. See, here it is. I hold it towards you. I'm pregnant." I think that Johnny knew it. I don't know for sure. I'm pregnant twice. Once with Johnny's child, and once with the Schroenloop memory of what he was. I don't know if the two are meant to be linked. It will be months before the child is born, and only days before I face the Shrike. But I remember those minutes after Johnny's torn body was taken out to the crowd, and before I was led away for help. They were all there in the darkness, hundreds of the priests and acolytes and exorcists and ostiaries and worshippers. And as one voice, they began to chant, there in that red dimness under the revolving sculpture of the Shrike, and their voices echoed in Gothic vaults. And what they chanted went something like this. "Blessed be she. Blessed be the mother of our salvation. Blessed be the instrument of our atonement. Blessed be the bride of our creation. Blessed be she." I was injured and in shock. I didn't understand it then. I don't understand it now. But I know that when the time arrives and the Shrike comes, Johnny and I will face it together.
It was long after dark. The tram car rode between stars and ice. The group sat in silence, the only sound the creak of cable. After a time had passed, Lenore Hoyt said to Braun Lamia, "You also carry the cruciform." Lamia looked at the priest. Colonel Cassad leaned toward the woman.
"Do you think Hetmestine was the Templar who had spoken to Johnny?"
"Possibly. I never found out."
Cassad did not blink.
"Were you the one who killed Mestine?"
"No."
Martin Silenus stretched and yawned.
"We have a few hours before sunrise. Anyone else interested in getting some sleep?"
Several heads nodded.
"I'll stay up to keep watch,"
said Fedmon Cassad.
"I'm not tired."
"I'll keep you company,"
said the consul.
"I'll heat some coffee for the therm."
When the others slept, the infant Rachel making soft cooing sounds in her sleep, the other three sat at the windows and watched the stars burn cold and distant in the high night.